Good afternoon, and welcome to the March meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience, coming to you through the good offices of Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for our president, Mac DeFord. The forum, now in its 32nd year, founded in 1983, bringing you on a monthly basis inform speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. Diplomatic policy, sometimes the absence thereof. Details about past and upcoming programs available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we're delighted to be able to bring you Andrew Coburn, who is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. In a long career, he has had four different roles simultaneously. He has been a journalist, author of half a dozen books, a political analyst, and a filmmaker. And I set out to track down at least one instance of each one of these different kinds of genre. And I'll tell you just a word or two about those. The available on harpers.com, a recent article he wrote about, can you believe it, America's partnership with Al-Qaeda, a covert partnership in which we have been spiriting weapons to Al-Qaeda to fight against Assad. You read it with disbelief, and yet you believe it because it's very credible what he's written. A 2003 article about slavery in the modern world, in which you meet not only some of the slaves, but some of the slave masters, who must have been rather threatening to deal with. I admire anybody who could go there and talk to them. A film, this one you got to track down. I will post a link to it. The film is called American Casino, and it is about the mortgage collapse, the mortgage crisis in 2008. How many of you have seen The Big Short or read the book? You know, to my mind, I read the book but didn't see the film, but to my mind, the story that Andrew tells with his wife, Leslie, who was the director of the film, Leslie Coburn, the story he tells is more striking and more memorable than The Big Short. And the first minute of the film is just a stark minute of a still picture of the Capitol and a voiceover telling you about who the real villain is of the, it was Phil Graham, by the way, who the real villain is. And by the time he's done with 1 minute of narration, you have to pick your jaw up from the table. It's so surprising and upsetting. And then the book I read was the Rumsfeld biography. I was just going to dip into it, but he's a good writer. It's hard to put something down, and he spoiled my whole weekend by... Andrew Coburn, welcome.
Well, thank you. I was assured this mic would go on automatically. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay, good. It's harpers.org, by the way, I have to say, as a loyal employee, if you want to look up my or any other articles in our excellent magazine. Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and I feel sort of very honored to be in this roster of speakers, including John Kiriakou, a very brave and principled fellow who's who was so unjustly imprisoned. It was completely outrageous. This is a topic I've, as I offered to, when asked what I want to talk about, I thought I'd really want to talk about our policy of assassination, and which is now our principal military strategy, and indeed I wrote this book about. And the first thing I have to say is, of course, it's illegal. Following the revelation in 1975, as in the backwash from Watergate, when it was revealed, came out, and suddenly it was revealed that we'd been pursuing a policy of assassinating foreign enemies over many years. The Congress and the entire, political establishment rose up in horror, and said this should be banned, and so indeed the president, President Ford, then President Carter, and then President Reagan issued executive orders saying an assassin, no agent of the officer of the United States should engage in assassination. And still, if you say, if you call up the administration or State Department and you say, you know, why are we assassinating people? They say, well, we don't. It's illegal by executive order. Solution, of course, has been very easy. They simply changed the name. So we don't do assassination. I want to make that absolutely clear. We engage only in high-value targeting. And it is a it's a policy that I'm interested to see that our president is still fully supports. We have this on the authority of a very interesting article that came out in the Atlantic a few days ago, with an enormously long screed called The Obama Doctrine, which was Obama basically explaining to a very sympathetic reporter why everything he's done was pretty much correct and anything that went wrong was somebody else's fault. He seems to have it in particularly for poor John Kerry, who was always trying to get him to do the wrong thing, and the president of Turkey is in his sights. Various people come in from some rather hard knocks. The conversation touched lightly, or maybe touched more than lightly in the actual conversation, but as related on what people think is the principal activity of U.S. counter-terror, U.S. policy against terrorism, which is drone assassinations. And according to the piece, everyone's right behind that. John Brennan, let me quote, John Brennan, Obama's CIA director, told me recently that he and the president, quote, have similar views. One of them is that sometimes you have to take a life to save even more lives. We have a similar view of just war theory. The president requires near certainty of no collateral damage, but if he believes it's necessary to act, he doesn't hesitate. Well, that's clear because since U.S. drone strikes really took off in late 2008, but really ramped up in 2009, because our president really believes this is the way to operate. But before I talk too much about what our current drone policy, I just want to sort of delve a little bit into how it evolved, because I think it might surprise people the way this policy of high-value targeting is really part of a whole doctrine of warfare that we've been working on since the 1930s. And it really came out of the Air Force, or the Army Air Force as it then was, and their desire to be an independent entity, independent of the Army. And in the late 30s at the Air Force Tactical Warfare School, they developed this theory of critical nodes, basically, that the way to deal with, the way you could wage war effectively and completely victoriously and cost-effectively from the air was by identifying the critical nodes in an enemy system. And they were talking about things at this point, like power stations and crucial bridges, you know, rail nexus, the railway yards and so forth, fuel production, oil production sites. And you could take those out, which you could do with the precision, thanks to the newly developed Norden bomb site, and then victory would be yours. So that on the eve of World War II, the Air Force's official plan said we have identified 154 targets in Germany, in the German war, which are crucial for the operation of the German war economy. We will destroy them. It might take a few months, but once we've destroyed them, the war will be over because Germany can no longer function as an industrial war-making power, and that'll be it. No need for fleets or armies or anything like that. Well, as we know, that didn't work so well. In fact, the targets, instead of 154, it became 1,000, 1,500, 15,000, 150,000. The targets expanded as, you know, they kept looking for the crucial one that would end the war. And, of course, they never found it, and it took millions of men and enormous invasions, indeed, to bring down Nazi Germany. I like to cite this because, you know, it shows how far back this thing goes, and also because really every other campaign that followed has gone the same way. When we get to the Vietnam War again, there was, you know, the idea they'd isolated the jugular of the North Vietnamese economy with some oil storage tanks outside Hanoi. And once we destroyed those, the Vietnamese would be out of oil and they'd be no longer able to send supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the war would be over. Well, that didn't work so well. Turned out they had lots of other tanks and the war went on and on and on for many years. In my book, you'll find what they tried to do then, which is too long a story to tell now, but it was an equally sort of technologically determined strategy. Then we go moving forward to the Iraq War, to when the next sort of major war really we engaged in with the 1991 Gulf War. Again, the same strategy, now much refined, and sort of because of the advent of very precise weapons, the TV-guided and laser-guided bombs and missiles. Now they thought we can really get those critical nodes, and there was the whole attack plan against Iraq was planned on that basis. And now, however, there was a new element sort of was creeping in, which was we saw not critical nodes weren't just things; they were could also be people. There was a pyramid in the planning office in the Pentagon, the Air Force planning office. They had this pyramid of targets of sort of greater and greater sensitivity and importance, and at the top was Saddam. This is before the war. Then someone remembered this old ban on assassination, so they crossed out Saddam and wrote in enemy command and control. It came to the same thing. And so this policy was pursued, and they particularly tried to made great efforts to kill Saddam without effect, because Saddam sort of, who was, you know, pretty well practiced in the assassination business himself, had seen this one coming. So as the chap who was his head of military intelligence at the time told me later, he said that I said, well, what precautions did Saddam take? And he said, well, no one knew where he was at any particular time. He wouldn't tell anyone apart from, he'd tell you who was coming to see, you'd expect to see him at some point during the day. He used to come to my headquarters every day. But he just came in a battered old Baghdad taxi with a driver who was an intelligence colonel. And then he'd leave and he wouldn't tell you where he was going. So no one knew where he was. And it was remarkably effective. They kept pounding various headquarters and it was nowhere to be found. The same thing happened in the 2003 invasion. They were even more explicitly trying to get him, and they dropped the pretense about enemy in command and control, and they again bombed numerous headquarters. And it turned out, of course, that they were in doing this, they hit numerous civilians. So as a rule came in, which has now become part of the whole strategy, which I'm jumping ahead slightly, it was the NCV, something referred to as NCV, which means non-combatant casualty cutoff failure, cutoff figure. Non-combatant casualty cutoff value. And that means the number of civilians you're allowed to kill when you're as collateral damage when you're pursuing a high-value target. So in that war, in 2003, the number was 30. You could plan an operation, you could get 30 people if you wanted, or 29, but if it was 30 or higher, you had to go ask the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, if it was okay. You were trying to get Saddam, and might be 30 or higher. But it wasn't too onerous, because in no case, this permission was asked, I'm told, 50 times at least 50 times, but in no case was it refused. So it was kind of full. At the moment, I'm told in this current war against ISIS, the number is 5, although it has been recently as high as 10. When General McChrystal was in charge in Afghanistan, I'm told the number was one because he was very down on collateral damage. So it goes around, but it's, you know, it's factored into the whole system, the NCV. You know, what's the NCV here? And, you know, people of different ranks. You know, if you're a captain, you can authorize an NCV of 10. If you're a colonel, you can go to a higher number. If you're a general, so forth. So it's all part of the machinery. Anyway, back to sort of the historical record. In the 90s, there was a new technology appeared. It wasn't that new. In fact, it wasn't new at all, but it was sort of, there'd been some breakthroughs, which was drones, which had been in use, certainly in, I mean, drones go back to the First World War when they were first developed, and they were abandoned for a while because they were considered to be inaccurate and unreliable, which was something that's kind of persisted, but now they look fancier. In the crucial thing that happened with drones in the sort of late 80s, late days of the Cold War and early 90s was the development of GPS, because now you could navigate a drone, when it was over the horizon when you couldn't see it. And also the development of broadband sort of information transmission, so that you could put a camera on the drone and it could transmit back pictures and you could see what it was looking, you know, where it was. And this really first was put into practice during the Balkan Wars of the 90s, and most spectacularly, most sort of first time really sort of in large volume during the Kosovo War of 1999. Which had an interesting effect. It became, this was high-ranking commanders now could be on the battlefield for the first time since the sort of Middle Ages, practically, or certainly since the 18th century. They could really see what was going on the battlefield. Well, this had been true in Vietnam when you had ascending tiers of helicopters where they'd all, you know, the colonel's, the captain's helicopter, the company commander's helicopter, the brigade commander, the corps commander, all up in helicopters, reaching up to the sky, all watching what some poor lieutenant trying to sort of save his platoon was doing down on the ground. But now you didn't have to go to the trouble of getting on a helicopter and being over the battlefield, albeit at great altitude. You could be back in your office and watch the whole thing on a screen. And an aide to General Wesley Clark, who was the commander in the Kosovo War, told me this is exactly what he did. He said Wes would sit there for hours on his bed. He's running this 27-nation coalition and, you know, fighting this war and so forth, very political war. But he'd spend hours of every day mesmerized by the UAV feed, the monitor on his desk. And at one point, he actually called up the head of the air campaign, who was meanwhile marshaling air fleets and everything, saying, hey, Mike, I can see those two tanks at the end of that bridge. Are you watching that? When are you going to take them out? You know, this is the commander-in-chief of NATO, sort of trying to direct a strike on two miserable Serbian tanks somewhere in a field in Kosovo. So that's, you know, it's had one, there's a very sort of effective drone warfare as it has developed, which is the sort of telescope effect that high commanders think they're in touch. Flashing forward to the operation against to kill Osama bin Laden, you've all seen that picture of the whole senior staff of the national security staff of this administration all sitting watching the screen. You know, that's all very dramatic, and there's Obama and the Secretary of State and numerous high officials. I think what I've been trying to figure out what they were looking at. They were looking at a very sort of muddy infrared picture taken from a drone high above the bin Laden compound. That's all they kind of been seeing. So they were, I don't know why they're looking so excited, because maybe for the photographer, because they couldn't really have been seeing much. Anyway, so the drone, having been considered on rather dubious evidence to have been a great success in the Kosovo War, it was of great interest to the CIA and great interest for the counterterrorism operations. And so in 2000, the CIA did drones a number of times over Afghanistan, And they took a particular took a particular look at a place called Tarnak Farms, which was thought where Osama bin Laden was known to frequent, or allegedly would. He wasn't the only person who went there, but they, sure enough, one day they get a picture back, and it's of Tarnak Farms, and there's a bunch of little, what all they can see is a bunch of little white dots. A white dot surrounded by little black dots. And this was interpreted as had to be Osama bin Laden himself, because he was, you know, wore pictures of him showed him, always showed him wearing a white robe. And the black dots, they would have to be bodyguards. And I've looked at this a lot of times, and all they really are just dots. You can maybe think they're human figures, but that's about it. Certainly oblong dots. But I've heard analysts say, well, they look kind of deferential. The black dots were behaving in a deferential manner against the white dot. And if you try blowing it up, all it just becomes blurry. It's not like you get a magnified view. But this picture had momentous effects because they thought, my God, it was Osama. If we'd only had a missile on that thing, we could have got him. And this was before 9/11. This was on the back of the, the attacks on the African embassies and the USS Cole. We could have got Mr. Big himself. They had no idea if it really was Osama. I mean, it looked like Osama. It was, would have been what we call a signature strike. It sort of looked like it might be Osama. It was in a place where Osama might be, disregarding the fact that it was also used by various of our friends from the Gulf who would go there to hunt bustards. We might have potted one of them, but anyway, that all such doubt was cast aside. The pictures went around Washington like wildfire. Everyone said, yes, do it now. So there was a crash program, quite a successful one, to fit a missile. Actually, it was originally developed as an anti-tank missile, the LFAR missile, onto the drone. And now they were ready for business. Then along comes 9/11. The president immediately is given a list of the, I think it started with 12 names, the 12 people who are the masterminds of this conspiracy that attacked us, headed by Osama and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and he kept it on his desk. And indeed, on the first night of the war on terror, the one that's still going on, or our counterattack in the war on terror, let's say, the entire U.S. High Command is all sitting, looking at their, of course, at their video screens, and looking at a picture from a drone, which is high over Kandahar, and it shows a Toyota Corolla, driving away from somewhere where Mullah Omar, who was also on that list, was thought to reside. And they were trying to decide whether they could, what should they do? And they're all watching this one car. They've just started a whole war, which they didn't know it was going to go on for the next 15 years at least, but they're all fixated on this one saloon car because that's what the drone could show them. And the drone stops and goes on, then it stops outside a mosque. And then they trying to, should they hit the mosque? People have gone inside. That requires extra permission. And eventually they ask Bush. The word gets to, Donald Rumsfeld calls George Bush saying, can they hit this car and mosque? And while they're mulling over that, the car suddenly explodes because meanwhile, the General Tommy Power, who is in charge of the actual invasion, has gotten sort of bored with all this chit-chat and just sort of says, oh, blow it up. As it so happened, Mullah Omar had been in the car, but they just parked it. He'd gone into a building. So he came out and jumped on a motorbike and rode off and was never seen again by any Westerner and has allegedly died recently. So it was kind of a sort of random shot. But that was the first attempt in this war to get a high-value target. And as I just said, it failed. It carried on. It was not so much, the Bush did it, killing, the next one was in Yemen in 2002. again, actually by accident, they killed an American citizen, and it was thought to be a, you know, they'd gotten an important Al-Qaeda individual that had something to do with attacking the coal. But what they didn't know was that the president of Yemen, who was purporting to be our ally, President Ali Abdullah Saleh, he'd been perfectly capable of attacking, of capturing this fellow if he'd wanted to, but he chose not to because it would cause all sorts of problems for him at home. So he simply told the Americans and said it was impossible to capture this fellow and he was deadly, he'd be a deadly threat if let loose. So, you know, we killed him with a drone. Again, you know, it's, and it was, anyways. Drones, however, as I'd mentioned earlier, drone attacks and the high-value targeting by other means really took off with this administration. They started to ramp up in the late 2008 when the CIA sought and obtained a permission from the White House, from the administration, to embark on what I mentioned, signature strikes. That's when you, as I said, when you don't actually know who's down there, but they look like, you know, you have all sorts of telling indicators to show that they are definitely bad people who might well pose a threat to you and your forces and should be eliminated and therefore can be attacked with a drone. And that's been actually the majority of our drone strikes, certainly in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I think in most of the countries, Yemen, Somalia too. So the numbers, but then when Obama came in and he was briefed on this by John Brennan, who he'd already taken a shine to, had been his counterterrorism advisor during the campaign, and he installed him in the White House, and they, and you know, Obama was sold on the whole, you know, the precision of it, and, you know, how good the intelligence is, and how, you know, how sort of how clean the whole thing was portrayed, and so he authorized it. And so by 2010, in Pakistan alone, we did 110 strikes, which escalated sharply after the enemy reacted and did a high-value targeting strike of their own, which was to get a suicide bomber into a CIA base in Host, just across the border from Pakistan, and killed seven CIA employees. And then we responded, and it was, became a became a sort of very high-tempo war at that point. I'd just like to, but I've been talking a lot about the precision, the alleged precision of these. Of this weapon. Just at the time when they were after this momentous picture of the white dot amid the black dots had hit Washington, the Air Force was ordering a lot more Predator drones, and they were also arming them, figuring out how to arm them meanwhile. So, and there's a law that says every new weapon adopted by the Air Force has, or any of the service, has to be tested. So accordingly, the Directorate of Operational Test and Evaluation took a Predator drone out to Nellis Air Force Base and put it through testing. And the results didn't get much publicity, certainly not from the Air Force, because it turned out that the thing was very, very unreliable. Basically, it only could recognize a target for what it was, you know, a truck or a tank or whatever, roughly 21% of the time. And the result that always interested me was that the at night with the infrared camera, which is you know, half the time, and it's when you, particularly when bad people are out and about, The infrared camera had a visual acuity of 20 over 200. You know, 20/20 vision is perfect vision. 20 over 200 is, you know, 1/10 of that. In fact, 20 over 200 vision is the legal definition of blindness among DMVs in this country. So Nevertheless, things have improved a bit, the technology, so I'm told, but not that much. So in effect, we've been killing people, sending an instrument and identifying people who need to be killed for years and years with an instrument that's legally blind, which I always find pretty remarkable. There was a whole host of sort of faults found with the Predator as a result of those tests. They were duly recorded and reported to the Congress and to the high ranks of the Defense Department, and no one took a blind bit of notice because we had this magic weapon that could go far away and you could control from the other side of the earth and eliminate your enemies cleanly without having, God preserve us, boots on the ground. I'm often asked, but surely it's better to have, to do it this way. It's less risky. You can't see, you're not risking American lives. And my response is, well, okay, but where has it got us? I mean, what are we trying to achieve, and how successful has it been? And I argue that it has not been successful in that we're still fighting roughly the same enemy. I mean, they call themselves by different names, and they've had their own splits. But whereas in 2001, Al-Qaeda seems to have been at most a couple of hundred people, many of them hiding out in caves in Afghanistan or lurking in apartments in Karachi, or some of them, the hijackers, in motels and rented apartments in this country, but basically was a pretty small group. And now, ISIS controls, a big, huge chunk of Iraq and a huge chunk of Syria, is making inroads in Libya, in Afghanistan, where they're battling the Taliban. The situation is not good. I mean, I can't blame it all on the failure of the principles, on the principle of strategy we've adopted, which is high-value targeting. But it would seem to have a lot to do with it, and it doesn't seem to have worked so well. So I think, we can have a failed strategy where you don't risk American lives, or a failed strategy where you do, but it's still a failed strategy. So maybe you can think of something else to do. I wanted to say a little bit more about why I'm so confident that this doesn't work. And this, remarkably, there's been very little studies done as to whether this, a policy of high-value targeting actually is effective, actually, makes your situation better or rather than worse. Many people argue with saying, well, of course it's bad because it antagonizes the subject population. And of course, many Pakistanis are now mad at us for our drone campaign, and ditto in Somalia, and ditto in Iraq, and ISIS-held Syria. And that's true. That's definitely true. I mean, you can, there's plenty of evidence to show that is the case, and that we do create enemies this way. But I was been interested, but in terms of defeating the opposition, how well does that work? And surprisingly or not surprisingly, this has been of little interest to the military establishment. They haven't. I looked in vain for a long time to see if anyone really looked into this. And then I found, yes, a interesting character who was an analyst a thing called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which is the Pentagon's sort of in-house think tank. He had been assigned in 2007 to go as part of a very secret intelligence cell attached to the commander, the ground commander, General Odierno in Baghdad. And Odierno, being quite a smart commander, had realized, like many others had done before him, that he couldn't trust the bureaucracy to give him the clear picture of what was going on, because the military bureaucracy obviously has its own interests at heart and will not necessarily give him the full truth all the time. So he had set up his own unit to tell him, to be his eyes and ears in the theater and to give him straight intelligence. And this guy, Rex Ravallo, this analyst from the Institute of Defense Analysis, was attached to it. And he got interested. The people kept saying, oh, you know, our principal strategy, of course, is HVI, and it's working great, and this is really, you know, this is how we're going to wear down the insurgency. But he'd go out in the field and he'd talk to units, you know, at these fire bases, these miserable fire bases scattered around the country, or the, you know, these FOBs, the forward operating bases. And he'd say, well, you know, how are you doing this strategy? Are you getting the enemy leaders? And they'd say, oh, yeah, we get one, pick one up once a week, but it doesn't do any good. He's always replaced. There's a new one the next day. He's usually worse. So, you know, we don't think it really getting us anywhere. So he went back to headquarters, and he had the ability to the power to call any information from anywhere in the theater, any intelligence he wanted. So he pulled out of the files 200 names of, they were called IED insurgent IED cell leaders from the files that had been killed or in some cases captured over the previous 4 months. Then he looked to see what had happened then. And the chap in, you know, in Ramadi, they, you know, killed him on a certain date. Did life get better for American forces in the neighborhood? Because if the theory was correct, elimination of an important local commander should have made life more peaceful. You know, one up for our side. No such thing occurred. Over 200 cases, on average, attacks on Americans within 3 days, attacks on American forces were up by 40%. And then it started to tail down. So at the end of a week, they were still up by 20%. And then over succeeding 2 or 3 weeks, they gradually tailed back to what they'd been before the guy had been killed. And this was clear, you know, very rigorously sort of analyzed evidence that this thing really wasn't working. And he briefed it to General Odierno, and said, well, you know, here's the result. And Odierno said, my hands are tied. I mean, you're right. I mean, implying you're right, but there's nothing I can do about it. So here was the American ground commander saying that the bureaucracy of this, behind this policy of effectively assassination, was so sort of ingrained, so embedded, that even he couldn't do anything about it. So I found that a very telling example. It hasn't had any effect, you know, as Obama told Mr. Goldberg of the Atlantic magazine, he's still very satisfied with this policy. They've been pursuing it against ISIS. They've been pursuing it in Somalia. All independent analysis seems to indicate that it's had no effect whatsoever in discommoding discommoding ISIS or the Shabab, and now they upped the ante by last week killing a large number of Shabab in one fell swoop. Also, they've captured some documents recently which show the Al Qaeda back in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They've their whole sort of plan for what to do. They now have a whole sort of system. Very, very organized, what to do when one of the commanders gets killed in a drone strike, you know, you do this, that, and the other, and how quickly you can replace him, which is in 24 hours, and so the merrier. So that's my case for our policy, why that we are pursuing a policy of assassination, and why it's not such a hot idea. Let's see, have I used up my allotted time frame for talking uninterruptedly, so perhaps I should ask for a question or two.
Okay, we'll take questions from the audience in writing. I'll start off, Andrew. There used to be a policy in the old West, wanted dead or alive. Would that be legal today to say that a criminal was so horrible that he was wanted dead or alive?
Well, George Bush said it apropos of Osama bin Laden, if you remember, right after. As the years went by and they didn't, you know, he was thought to be alive, but certainly not in our hands. That kind of Bush people stopped talking about that, and he was downgraded as a target, and then Obama, as we know, succeeded. But yeah, it would be legal. You know, they've generated a raft of legal opinions from inside the administration of why it's okay, even when it's the person in the target in question is an American citizen. They've taken care of that. I mean, it's a pretty squishy legal opinion, but still, there it exists.
Well, you seem to be making a case against high-value targeting. Is that just because of the nature of the insurgency, that it's more Hydra-headed than, for instance, a national army would be? I think back to the assassination of Yamamoto. Admiral Yamamoto was killed at the Coral Sea by a very closely targeted assassination, and that was judged to be a great success in hampering the Japanese war effort.
Well, it was, yeah. That's often claimed. That's often trotted out as, you know, the big success story. In fact, if you look at it, I mean, Yamamoto, you know, was this brilliant commander who'd sort of masterminded Pearl Harbor and then gone on to lose the Battle of Midway. But the policy that he was pursuing, the strategy he was pursuing at the same time he was killed, was continued by his successor. He didn't seem to have any brilliant strokes in mind. He might have pulled something out later on, but it doesn't. I'm certainly not a historian of the Pacific War, but it does look to me like it didn't make that much difference. It basically, and I mentioned this in my book. I mean, I looked a lot at the coverage of the time, and Yamamoto being built up as this hate figure. I mean, particularly, I can't remember the exact words. My own magazine, Harper's, had put some particularly sort of venomous and racist things to say about him. So I think it was really an act of revenge. I would say also in the same war, the British had you can't think, if only they'd gotten Hitler. The British actually had quite a well-developed plan to assassinate Hitler, involved when he went to his country mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden. They discovered that he took a walk every afternoon without guards, from the main house down to a little tea house. It was his sort of afternoon ramble. And they figured they could get a sniper in there and get him on that walk. But then a bunch of people within British intelligence said, no, this is a terrible idea. You know, we're fighting to defeat Nazism. If we kill Hitler, he'll be a martyr. And, you know, the war will go on. And, you know, and furthermore, Hitler's making all these incredible blunders. You know, he might be succeeded by someone competent. He's like our best agent. We should leave him. We definitely have to leave him there. And that argument got a lot of sway. In fact, the operation had to be folded for other reasons, because Hitler didn't go to Berchtesgaden again after they decided to go ahead. But if you read that criticism of why it was a bad idea, I think it really holds true for the whole strategy throughout history.
Well, you've undone half the questions which had to do with assassinating Hitler. what alternative to high-value targeting would you suggest that might be more effective?
Well, that's always the one that's meant to trap me, because on the presumption we've got to do something. I would say it's better to do nothing than do something that's, as I've argued at least, clearly counterproductive. There have been successful counterinsurgency campaigns, and everyone is different. The British in Northern Ireland, for example, they were ultimately very successful in not in killing the enemy leadership, which they had done for a while, or capturing them, but of letting them play, and, you know, very artfully inserting double agents into their ranks. Obviously, tricky proposition with ISIS, but wasn't so easy with the IRA either. But in the end they did, and they were able to influence policy. Any of the particular wars, there's a different strategy one can suggest that argue would be a bit better than this high-value targeting business, which takes up an enormous amount of resources, I should say, and something I haven't gone into, of course, is very costly and therefore very appealing to the military-industrial bureaucracy. Against ISIS, clearly the more successful strategy is the one currently being pursued by the Russians and the Syrian army, which is to cut off their supply routes from Turkey. That seems to be having an effect. Lowering the price of oil, which obviously this wasn't the object of the exercise, that's cut deeply into ISIS operations. They've had to, because the price of oil, they're getting so little for their oil now, they've had to halve the salaries, everyone's salaries. So you're sort of, if you're an ISIS fighter, your salary's just been cut in half. I don't know, there's all sorts of things, but what I object to is this sort of mechanistic approach to the enemy. The enemy is this sort of fixed structure, and if we take out a key component, whether, you know, in olden days it's a bridge or a, you know, communications tower or a person, then wonderful things flow from that. And I find that such a sort of unappealingly mechanistic approach to conflict that it's bound not to work. And so it's the case I could have talked about the drug war where the same thing happened. But,
Is that the appeal of it, that it is so mechanistic, it's simplistic?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
I believe so. You know, it's one best adapted to the operations of a huge structure like our military industrial apparatus. It requires, you know, people talk about, you know, drones themselves are quite, just as a drone, it's quite a simple thing. One drone general described them to me as just fiberglass in the sky. The two things they have is a sort of fairly simple, I mean, they have a simple engine and a camera or an array of cameras, and a transmission dish to send it back up to the satellite. But it's the whole apparatus that's been built up around it. I mean, in this country, they have five major what they call distributed common ground system complexes, which are basically on military bases. They're enormous facilities. I've been in one. It's sort of huge. Thousands of people, 2,000 people working there, which are rows and rows and rows of men and women in uniform, in sort of fatigues, looking at screens. It reminded me of a Wall Street trading room. They're all sort of staring at telling screens. And that is getting the feed from all the drones and all the satellites and all the U-2s. And one half of the room was actually occupied by NSA people who were listening to all the sort of communications traffic. And what they were doing was basically, you know, overseeing operations. And the idea was, the presumption behind this, and they each cost like $1 billion to build, and there's five of them in this country and two more overseas, and lots of sort of sub ones, smaller variations of the same around the country. And it's this underlying presumption, I guess getting the heart of this, what I'm saying about the mechanistic approach, is that we can see everything nowadays. With the wonders of surveillance, we can see everything, and therefore we can pretty much know everything, especially because we can listen to everything as well. And if you know everything, then you can, and we can also hit anything because we're so precise with our weapons technology. And because of knowing everything, we know exactly who to hit, and you know, and we also know what the effect it will be. And this is the sort of doctrine which was sort of dreamt up to justify all this, called effects-based operations, i.e. that you can do an operation and really figure out the sort of second and third order effects. You know, you hit this particular, you know, gas station, and you know that the ISIS commander needs that to gas up his vehicle, so he won't be able to get some. I mean, I'm making that up, but that's the sort of line of thinking behind it. And of course, it doesn't work so well, because I argue that you can never, anyway, be inside the enemy that effectively to know, you know, to know everything. And you certainly can't see anything, considering you're legally blind half the time, see everything. So the whole thing falls apart, but it's extremely satisfying for all sorts of reasons, including the vast budgetary nourishment it brings to the relevant organizations.
Well, is it possible that this withdrawal from being on the ground, which has been facilitated by the drones, has resulted in us having less and less real intelligence? I mean, when we actually had people in Iraq, they had the possibility to reach out to their counterparts and learn more about what was going on and who was who. So aren't we withdrawing ourselves from the entire business of deep intelligence
right,
by not being there?
Yeah, I mean, that's in institutionally, that's certainly the case. So I've been told at the CIA, for example, the way you sort of made your name at the CIA, again, so people have told me, and these are usually old lags sort of grumbling about the way things have gone downhill, but still sounds true to me, that they it used to be that you were out in the, if you were out in the field, I mean, you got ahead by being out in the field and out at, you know, stations overseas, or, you know, recruiting agents, recruiting informants and so forth, and that's how you got ahead and got promoted on the business. Now, ambitious people, ambitious young CIA people want to stay at headquarters because you get to brief. You get to brief higher ups all the time on the basis of what you're seeing on or hearing on intercepts and seeing on the screens, because the CIA has its own sort of DCGS facility. So it's all more remote. So you're more and more disengaged from the world. I mean, I could go on and would take another hour to weigh other ways I see this happening with the, you know, with just with fighter planes, where basically the fighter plane, the pilot doesn't hardly looks out of the window anymore, hardly can look out of the window anymore. It all has to be on a screen in front of him. Yeah, I mean, the answer to your question is yes.
A couple of questions about legal consequences. Have there been any legal consequences? If assassination is illegal, has anybody contested the policy?
No. I mean, people have contested it, but I mean, your next speaker, Mr. Kiriakou, is going to tell you what happens to the, he was talking about torture, but what happens to anyone who speaks out? No, I mean, there have been whistleblowers, but surprisingly few. I mean, I talked to people inside the programs who, you know, begged me for obvious reasons not to make their names public or anything like that. But there were four drone operators came out last year. Who were fairly low level, there were sensor operator, people who at the sort of the low end of the program, I mean the people at the coalface, so to speak, and their principal point they made was they said drone operations are a recruiting agent for ISIS, you know, which I thought should have gotten more publicity than it did.
We had Gregory Johnson here, the Yemen specialist, and he made exactly that point, that we were just doing tremendous amounts of damage. Recruiting, being a recruiting engine for the local insurgency in Yemen, for instance. Was there any blowback against the officer who okayed the drone attack against Mullah Omar without higher authorization?
Well, he was a four-star general who, having conquered Afghanistan, came home and got to work on the $5 million book contract he'd signed. Yeah. Well, he gives a rather mendacious account, but very interesting nonetheless, account of the Mullah Omar operation, including the fact that while he was ordering this, the chief of staff of the Air Force was watching in another room, was watching his drone monitor, of course, and rather malignly, after they'd blown up the car, malignly called Franks and said, hey, I think I saw people get out of that car before you hit it. And Franks's response was to order that the drone monitor be removed from the chief of staff of the Air Force.
What happens if an attack exceeds the NCV number? Are there consequences for that?
We haven't seen any. They always announce that there's going to be an investigation. Oh my God, we're sorry this has happened. We deeply regret. We're mounting an investigation. I've got about, I don't know how many FOIA requests I've got in right now, because I always apply, put in a Freedom of Information request to get the investigation. I've been lucky, but I've been unlucky, I mean, so far. But I opened the book. There is one. There was one investigation, a very good investigation of an attack in 2010 that killed 23 people in Afghanistan. And the investigation was run, this is when Stanley McChrystal was the commander in Afghanistan, and whatever you think of him, he was actually, he really got the idea that civilian casualties are a bad idea. He practically canceled most airstrikes. And while on his watch, a drone crew in Nevada oversaw an attack on what they said was convinced was a Taliban convoy of three cars. It was actually three cars full of poor people on their way to Kabul to look for work. And they killed 23 people. And McChrystal ordered an investigation. He got a friend of his who he trusted, another general, to do the investigation, who did a very thorough and very sort of powerful investigation, and then which was then declassified, I think, for something thanks really to some internecine bureaucratic battle with the Air Force by the Army. Anyway, I opened my first chapter of my book is all about that strike, from which we can learn a great deal. I learned a very great deal about how these things actually operate.
Is this just another problem of the military-industrial complex? Is there some way in which this policy benefits the Rockwell Internationals and the Boeings of the world so that they're keeping it going?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes. They do keep going. I mean, our lethal drones, the current ones, the Predators and the Reapers, are built by this company, General Atomics, in San Diego, which in the scale of things is, comparatively speaking, rather minor player in the military-industrial complex. I think it's like number 20 and 19 or 20 in current values of contracts. But they're all in it. I mean, I'll give you a good example. There's another drone, which is just a surveillance drone called Global Hawk, which is a huge thing, has a wingspan like a 747. And it's meant to be able to stay awake a lot for weeks at a time and go sort of halfway around the world and do wonderful things. And the Air Force, but the point is, it's actually basically a piece of junk. I mean, which was the word senior defense official I was talking to about it used me. It can't fly when the weather's bad. It's sort of all made of plastic, sort of stealthy, for reasons of stealth, it's made of plastic, but the glue doesn't work so good, so bits fall off. So the Air Force moved, said, oh, this thing really isn't any use. We'd sooner spend our money somewhere else. The Northrop, the manufacturers, organized a sort of nationwide campaign, and on its website for employees, you know, had helpfully all the lists, you know, tell your friends and family to call congressman. This is your congressman, call him, you know, complain that this vital element of our defense is being thrown away by witless characters. So, and they succeeded. You know, the Global Hawk was suddenly rescued. So it was this completely useless thing, which cost $200 million a copy, by the way, was saved from the junkyard just for the... It was a perfect example of the military-industrial complex in action.
What better way to end than a tale of saving the military-industrial complex? Thank you, Andrew.
Hey, you're welcome.